16. Aftermath. With the battalion's contribution to the final solution complete, and the tide of war turning against Germany, the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 increasingly found themselves in action against armed partisans and enemy soldiers. In the spring of 1943, the battalion experienced a rare casualty when First Lieutenant Hagen was killed accidentally by police gunfire. In the last year of the war, the toll among the officers rose dramatically. Lieutenants Gnade, Hoppner, and Peters fell in action, and Lieutenant Drucker returned to Germany wounded. Major Trapp also returned to Germany in early 1944. A few of the men were captured by the advancing Russian army, but most made their way back to Germany as the Third Reich collapsed in defeat. Many resumed their pre-war occupations. For the two SS Hauptsturmführers, Hoffmann and Wolow, as well as 12 from the sample of 32 non-commissioned officers, this meant an ongoing career in the police. Another 12 policemen from the rank-and-file sample of 174 managed to put their reserve service to good use and made a post-war career in the police. Not surprisingly, the interrogations contained little information about the ease with which these 26 men continued in the police. While only two of the reservists had been party members, 9 of the NCOs had belonged, and 3 had been in the SS as well. Hoffmann and Wolow, of course, had also been in both the party and the SS. Hoffmann mentioned a brief period of internment by the British due to his SS membership. Though interrogated by Polish authorities, he was released and immediately rejoined the Hamburg police. Ironically, it was not the hardcore SS officers who suffered post-war difficulties because of Reserve Police Battalion 101's actions in Poland, but Major Trapp and Lieutenant Buchmann. One policeman who had been in the firing squad at Tałczyn was denounced by his estranged wife. Under interrogation, he named his battalion commander Trapp, his company commander Buchmann, and his first sergeant Kammer. All of them were extradited to Poland in October 1947. On July 6, 1948, they had a one-day trial in the city of Siedlce. The trial focused solely on the reprisal shooting of 78 Poles in Tałczyn, not on any of the battalion's murderous and far more numerous actions against Polish Jews. The policemen and Trapp were sentenced to death and executed in December 1948. Buchmann was sentenced to 8 years in prison, and Kammer to 3. Reserve Police Battalion 101 was not subjected to further judicial investigation until the 1960s. In 1958, the Zentrale Stelle der Landesjustizverwaltungen, Central Agency for the State Administration of Justice, headquartered in the town of Ludwigsburg, just north of Stuttgart, was formed to initiate and coordinate the prosecution of Nazi crimes. The staff of the Zentrale Stelle was organized into various task forces, each assigned to investigate various crime complexes. Only after they had conducted the initial research into a particular crime complex and discovered the whereabouts of the highest-ranking suspects did they assign jurisdiction to the office of the state prosecutor of the federal state in which the prime suspect or suspects lived. It was in the course of investigating various crime complexes in the district of Lublin that Ludwigsburg investigators first encountered several witnesses from Reserve Police Battalion 101. In 1962, the case was turned over to police and judicial authorities in Hamburg, where most of the surviving battalion members still lived. From late 1962 to early 1967, 210 former members of the battalion were interrogated, many of them more than once. 14 men were indicted. Captains Hoffmann and Wolow, Lieutenant Drucker, Sergeants Steinmetz, Bentheim, Beckemeyer, and Grund, Corporals Grafmann and Mähler, and 5 reserve policemen. The trial began in October 1967, and the verdict was rendered the following April. Hoffmann, Wolow, and Drucker were sentenced to 8 years, Bentheim to 6, Beckemeyer to 5. Grafmann and 5 reserve policemen were declared guilty, but at the judge's discretion, under a provision of the 1940 criminal code that governed the trial, so as to avoid the criticism leveled at the Nuremberg trials of applying ex post facto law, they were given no sentence. Grund, Steinmetz, and Mähler were not included in the verdict, as their cases had been separated during the trial because of their failing health. A lengthy appeals process finally concluded in 1972. The convictions of Bentheim and Beckemeyer were upheld, but they also received no sentence. Hoffman's sentence was reduced to 4 years, Drucker's to 3.5 years. The case pending against other members of the battalion was dropped by the prosecution in light of its inability to get sentences against any but 3 defendants in the first trial. However inadequate the post-war judicial outcome may seem at first sight, it must be kept in mind that the investigation of Reserve Police Battalion 101 was one of the few that led to the trial of any former members of the Order Police. Most of the investigations of police battalions did not even lead to indictments. In the few cases that did come to trial, only a handful of convictions were obtained. Comparatively speaking, the investigation and trial of Reserve Police Battalion 101 was a rare success for German judicial authorities attempting to deal with the police battalions. The interrogations of 210 men from Reserve Police Battalion 101 remain in the archives of the Office of the State Prosecutor in Hamburg. They constitute the prime, indeed indispensable, source for this study. It is to be hoped that the admirable efforts of the prosecution in preparing this case will serve history better than they have served justice. 17. Germans, Poles, and Jews. The pre-trial and courtroom testimonies of the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 must, of course, be used with considerable caution. Problems of judicial calculation involving both self-incrimination and incrimination of comrades weighed heavily upon each witness. The effects of 25 years of memory loss and distortion, even when not feigned for judicial convenience, were equally important. Psychological defense mechanisms, especially repression and projection, crucially shaped the testimony as well. Nowhere do all these qualifications about the reliability of the testimonies become more problematic than in connection with the fateful triangle of German-Polish-Jewish relations. Simply put, the portrayal of German-Polish and German-Jewish relations in these testimonies is extraordinarily exculpatory. In contrast, the portrayal of Polish-Jewish relations is extraordinarily damning. If we begin by examining the first two relationships as described by the former policeman, we can better see the asymmetry and distortion involved in their account of the third. Concerning German-Polish relations, the most salient feature is the scarcity of any comment. The men make general references to partisans, bandits, and robbers, but the thrust of their comments is not the specifically anti-German character of such phenomena. On the contrary, they depict banditry as an endemic problem that predated the German occupation of Poland. Thus, they invoke the presence of partisans and bandits in two ways. On the one hand, to imply that the Germans were protecting Poles from indigenous problems of lawlessness, and on the other hand, to obscure the frequency and intensity of the battalion's anti-Jewish activities by alleging that partisans and bandits, not Jews, were the chief preoccupation of the policemen. Some of the witnesses referred to specific attempts at maintaining good German-Polish relations. Captain Hoffmann explicitly boasted of friendly relations between his company and the native population of Puławy. He claimed that he filed charges against Lieutenant Messmann because the shoot-on-sight tactics of the latter's marauding motorized gendarmerie were embittering the Poles. Lieutenant Buchmann noted that Major Trapp carried out the selection of victims for the Tałczyn reprisal shootings in consultation with the Polish town mayor. Care was taken to shoot only strangers and the destitute, not citizens of good standing. This picture of a rather benign German occupation in Poland was contradicted by only 2 testimonies. Bruno Probst recalled early activities of the battalion in Poznań and Łódź in 1940-41, when the policemen carried out brutal expulsions and amused themselves with cruel harassments of the local population. He was even more critical of German treatment of Poles in 1942. Even at that time, denunciations or comments from envious neighbors sufficed for Poles to be shot along with their entire families on the mere suspicion of possessing weapons or hiding Jews or bandits. As far as I know, Poles were never arrested and turned over to the competent police authorities on these grounds. From my own observations and from the stories of my comrades, I recall that when the above-mentioned grounds for suspicion were at hand, we always shot Poles on the spot. The second witness to challenge the rosy view of German-Polish relations was not a surviving policeman, but the wife of Lieutenant Brandt, who had visited him briefly in Radzin. At the time it was quite usual, she said, even for German civilians, to say nothing of uniformed policemen, to behave toward the Poles as a master race. For instance, when Germans walked down a sidewalk in town, Poles were to step aside. When Germans entered a shop, Polish customers were expected to leave. One day her way was barred by some hostile Polish women in Radzin. She and her companion got away only by threatening to call for the police. When Major Trapp heard of the incident, he was incensed. The Polish women should be shot in the public marketplace, he declared. According to Frau Brandt, this incident was illustrative of the German attitude toward the Poles. In terms of sexual relations between German policemen and Polish women, there were only two references. Hoffmann claimed to have protected one of his men by not reporting a case of venereal disease contracted through forbidden intercourse with a Pole. Another policeman was not so fortunate. He spent 1 year in a punishment camp for violating the ban on sexual relations with Poles. The very existence of such a ban, of course, says a great deal about the reality of German-Polish relations, so conveniently omitted from the bulk of the testimony. Could the German policemen have done to the Poles what they did to the Jews? Though on a much smaller scale, the same process of growing callousness and indifference to Polish life seems to have set in. In September 1942 in Tulcyn, the battalion was still cautious about the effect of reprisal shootings of large numbers of Poles. After killing 78 expendable Poles, Trapp met his reprisal quota by shooting Jews instead. Bruno Probst recalled a different attitude prevailing by January 1943. As Hoppner's 2nd Platoon of 3rd Company was about to go to the movies in Opole, they received reports that a German policeman had been shot by Polish assailants. Hoppner took his men to the village of Gniezdów to carry out a reprisal, only to discover that all but the most elderly inhabitants had fled. Even though word came in the middle of the action that the German policeman had only been wounded and not killed, Hoppner had all 12 to 15 elderly Poles, mostly women, shot, and the village burned down. The men then returned to the movie theater in Opole. The testimony is marked by similar omissions concerning German attitudes toward Jews. One reason for this is a stark legal consideration. According to German law, among the criteria for defining homicide as murder is the presence of a base motive, such as racial hatred. Any member of the battalion who openly confessed to anti-Semitism would have seriously compromised his legal position. Anyone who talked about the anti-Semitic attitudes of others risked finding himself in the uncomfortable position of witness against his former comrades. But this reluctance to discuss anti-Semitism was also part of a much more general and pervasive reticence about the whole phenomenon of National Socialism and the policemen's own political attitudes or those of their comrades during that period. To admit an explicitly political or ideological dimension to their behavior, to concede that the morally inverted world of National Socialism, so at odds with the political culture and accepted norms of the 1960s, had made perfect sense to them at the time, would be to admit that they were political and moral eunuchs who simply accommodated to each successive regime. That was a truth with which few either wanted or were able to come to grips. Captain Hoffmann, who joined the Nazi high school student organization at 16, the Hitler Youth at 18, and both the party and the SS at 19, offered the usual denial of the political and ideological dimension. My entry into the General SS in May 1933 is explained by the fact that at that time the SS was seen as a purely defensive formation. No special ideologically based attitude on my part lay at the root of my entry. Considerably less dishonest, though still evasive, was the explanation of Lieutenant Drucker, the only defendant who seriously attempted to grapple with the problem of his past attitude. I received National Socialist ideological training only within the framework of training in the SA, and a certain influence was present from the propaganda of the time. Because I was a platoon leader in the Naval SA, and it was desirable at the time that platoon leaders were also party members, I entered the party shortly before the outbreak of the war. Under the influence of the times, my attitude to Jews was marked by a certain aversion, but I cannot say that I especially hated Jews. In any case, it is my impression now that that was my attitude at the time. The few cases in which policemen testified to the brutality and anti-Semitism of others usually involved comments about particular officers by men from the ranks. With some reluctance, for instance, witnesses admitted that Gnade was a brutal, sadistic drunkard who was a Nazi and anti-Semite out of conviction. Two sergeants were also the subject of quite negative comments in several testimonies. Rudolf Grund, who deputized for Buchmann when the latter was excused from participating in Jewish actions, was nicknamed the Poison Dwarf because he compensated for his short stature by screaming at his men. He was characterized as especially harsh and loud, a real go-getter, and a 110% Nazi who displayed a great zeal for duty. Heinrich Beckemeyer was described as a very unpleasant man who proudly wore his Nazi insignia at all times. Disliked by his men, he was especially feared by Poles and Jews, toward whom he was brutal and cruel. One of his men recounted how Beckemeyer forced a group of Jews near Womazi to crawl through a mud puddle while singing. When an exhausted old man collapsed and raised his hands to Beckemeyer begging for mercy, the sergeant shot him in the mouth. Heinrich Beckemeyer, the witness concluded, was a common dog. But such denunciations by the policemen, even of unpopular superiors, much less of their comrades, were extremely rare. A range of attitudes toward Jews is revealed in less direct and less guarded statements made during the interrogations. For instance, when asked how they could tell the difference between Poles and Jews in the countryside, some of the men cited clothing, hairstyle, and general appearance. Several, however, chose a vocabulary that still reflected the Nazi stereotype of 25 years earlier. The Jews were dirty, unkempt, and less clean in comparison to the Poles. The comments of other policemen reflected a different sensibility that recognized the Jews as victimized human beings. They were dressed in rags and half-starved. A similar dichotomy is reflected in descriptions of Jewish behavior at the shooting sites. Some stressed Jewish passivity, occasionally in a very exculpatory way that seemed to imply that the Jews were complicit in their own deaths. There was no resistance, no attempt to escape. The Jews accepted their fate. They practically lay down to be shot without waiting to be told. In other descriptions, the emphasis was clearly on the dignity of the victims. The composure of the Jews was astonishing and unbelievable. The few references to sexual relations between Germans and Jews give a picture very different from forbidden romance or even quick sexual gratification between German policemen and Polish women. In cases involving German men and Jewish women, it was a question of domination over the powerless, of rape and voyeurism. The one policeman who was witnessed attempting to rape a Jewish woman was in fact the same man who was later denounced by his wife to Allied occupation authorities, extradited to Poland, and tried with Trapp, Buchmann, and Kammer. The witnessing NCO did not report the rapist. The second case involved Lieutenant Peters, who would get drunk on vodka in the evening and make night patrols in the ghetto. Booted and spurred, he entered Jewish dwellings, tore the bed covers off women, looked, and then left. By morning, he was sober again. For the most part, the Jews remained an anonymous collective in the German accounts. There were two exceptions. First, the policemen frequently mentioned encountering German Jews, and were almost always able to remember exactly the hometown from which the Jew in question came. The decorated World War I veteran from Bremen, the mother and daughter from Kassel, the movie theater owner from Hamburg, the Jewish council head from Munich. The experience must have been quite unexpected and jarring, in sharp contrast to their usual view of the Jews as part of a foreign enemy, to have remained in their memories so vividly. The other Jewish victims who took on a personal identity in the eyes of the German policemen were those who worked for them, particularly in the kitchen. One policeman remembered procuring extra rations for the Jewish work detail he supervised in Wukuf, because the Jews received practically nothing at all to eat, even though they had to work for us. The same man claimed to have allowed the wife of the head of the Jewish ghetto police to escape when the ghetto was being cleared. In Mianjizets, a kitchen worker begged another policeman to save her mother and sister during a ghetto clearing, and he let her bring them to the kitchen as well. In Kotsk, a policeman encountered a weeping Jewish woman during the late September shooting and sent her to the kitchen. But the tenuous relations that developed between the police and their Jewish kitchen helpers seldom saved lives in the end. When his two kitchen helpers did not come to work during a deportation from Wukuf, one policeman went to the collection point. He found both, but the SS man in charge allowed only one to go. A short while later, she was taken too. Most vividly of all, the policeman remembered those occasions when they not only did not save their Jewish workers, but in fact were supposed to carry out the executions themselves. In Puławy, Captain Hoffmann summoned Corporal Nering to his bedroom, gave him a gift of good wine, and told him to go to the agricultural estate he had formerly guarded and shoot the Jewish workers. Nering complained of the assignment because he personally knew many of the Jewish workers there, but to no avail. He and his unit shared the assignment with a gendarmerie officer and four or five men also stationed in Puławy. Nering told the officer that many of the Jews were well known to him, and he could not take part in the shooting. More obliging than Hoffmann, the officer had his men shoot the 15 to 20 Jews on their own, so that Nering did not have to be present. In Kotsk, two Jewish kitchen workers, Bluma and Ruth, asked for help to escape. One policeman advised them that it was pointless, but others helped them get away. 2 weeks later, some of the policemen found Bluma and Ruth hiding in a bunker along with a dozen other Jews. One of the men who recognized them tried to leave because he knew what was coming. He was ordered to shoot them instead. He refused and left anyhow, but all the Jews in the bunker, including the former kitchen helpers, were shot. In Komarovka, Drucker's 2nd Platoon of 2nd Company had two Jewish kitchen workers known as Yuta and Harry. One day, Drucker said they could not stay any longer and there was nothing left to do but shoot them. Some of the policemen took Yuta to the woods and engaged her in conversation before she was shot from behind. Shortly thereafter, Harry was shot in the back of the head with a pistol while he was picking berries. The policemen had clearly taken extra pains to shoot unawares victims who had prepared their food over the past months and whom they knew by name. By 1942, standards of German-Jewish relations, a quick death without the agony of anticipation, was considered an example of human compassion. While the policemen's testimonies offer scant information concerning German attitudes toward Poles and Jews, they contain very frequent and quite damning comment on Polish attitudes toward Jews. At least two factors must be kept in mind in evaluating this testimony. First, the German police quite naturally had considerable contact with Poles who collaborated in the Final Solution and helped them track down Jews. Indeed, such Poles attempted to curry favor with the German occupiers through their zealous anti-Semitism. Needless to say, Poles who helped Jews did their very best to remain totally unknown to the Germans. Thus, there was an inherent bias in the sympathies and behavior of the Poles with whom the German policemen had first-hand experience. This inherent one-sidedness is, in my opinion, further distorted by a second factor. It is fair to speculate that a great deal of projection was involved in German comments on Polish anti-Semitism, often unwilling to make accusatory statements about their comrades or to be truthful about themselves. These men must have found considerable psychological relief in sharing blame with the Poles. Polish misdeeds could be spoken about quite frankly, while discussion about Germans was quite guarded. Indeed, the greater the share of Polish guilt, the less remained on the German side. In weighing the testimony that follows, these reservations must be borne in mind. The litany of German accusation against the Poles began, like the mass murder itself, with the account of Józefów. The Polish mayor provided flasks of schnapps to the Germans on the marketplace, according to one policeman. According to others, Poles helped roust Jews from their dwellings and revealed Jewish hiding places in garden bunkers or behind double walls. Even after the Germans had finished searching, Poles continued to bring individual Jews to the marketplace throughout the afternoon. They entered Jewish houses and began to plunder as soon as the Jews were taken away. They plundered the Jewish corpses when the shooting was over. The classic accusation was made by Captain Hoffmann, a man who claimed to remember absolutely nothing about the massacre his company had carried out at Końskowola. In contrast, he remembered the following in exquisite detail. After the outer cordon had been lifted and his third company had moved into the town center at Józefów, two Polish students invited him into their house for a vodka. The young Poles exchanged Greek and Latin verses with Hoffmann, but did not hide their political views. Both were Polish nationalists who expressed themselves angrily over how they were treated and thought that Hitler had only one redeeming feature, that he was liberating them from the Jews. Virtually no account of the Jew hunts omitted the fact that hideouts and bunkers were for the most part revealed by Polish agents, informants, forest runners, and angry peasants. But the policeman's word choice revealed more than just information about Polish behavior. Time and again they used the word betrayed, with its unquestionable connotation of strong moral condemnation. Most explicit in this regard was Gustav Michelson. I found it very disturbing at the time that the Polish population betrayed these Jews who had hidden themselves. The Jews had camouflaged themselves very well in the forest, in underground bunkers or in other hiding places, and would never have been found if they had not been betrayed by the Polish civilian population. Michelson belonged to the minority of weak policemen who never shot and could thus voice his moral criticism with less than total hypocrisy. The same cannot be said for most others who accused the Poles of betrayal, never mentioning that it was German policy to recruit such people and reward such behavior. Once again, it was the ruthlessly honest Bruno Probst who put the matter in more balanced perspective. Often the Jew hunts were instigated by tips from Polish informants, he noted. But he added, I further remember that at the time we also gradually began, more systematically than before, to shoot Poles who provided lodging to Jews. Almost always we burned down their farms at the same time. Aside from the policeman who testified about the Polish woman who was surrendered by her father and shot for hiding Jews in her cellar in Kotsk, Probst was the sole man among 210 witnesses to acknowledge the existence of a German policy of systematically shooting Poles who hid Jews. Probst also related another story. On one occasion, Lieutenant Hoppner was leading a patrol that uncovered a bunker with 10 Jews. A young man stepped forward and said that he was a Pole who had hidden there in order to be with his bride. Hoppner gave him the choice of leaving or being shot with his Jewish wife. The Pole stayed and was shot. Probst concluded that Hoppner never meant the offer seriously. The Pole would certainly have been shot trying to escape if he had decided to leave. The German policeman described other examples of Polish complicity. At Końskowola, one policeman in the cordon was approached by a woman dressed as a Polish peasant. The nearby Poles said that she was a Jew in disguise, but the policeman let her pass anyhow. A number of policemen told of Poles arresting and holding Jews until the Germans could come and shoot them. On several occasions, the Jews had been beaten when the Germans arrived. Only one witness, however, told of Polish policemen accompanying the German patrols and taking part in the shooting on two occasions. In contrast, Tony Bentheim recounted what happened when the Polish police in Komarówka reported that they had captured 4 Jews. Drucker ordered Bentheim to shoot them. After he had taken the Jews to the cemetery, where he intended to shoot all 4 by himself, his submachine gun jammed. He thereupon asked the Polish policeman who had accompanied him if he wanted to take care of it. To my surprise, however, he refused. Bentheim used his pistol. The German portrayals of Polish complicity are not false. Tragically, the kind of behavior they attributed to Poles is confirmed in other accounts and occurred all too often. The Holocaust, after all, is a story with far too few heroes and all too many perpetrators and victims. What is wrong with the German portrayals is a multifaceted distortion in perspective. The policemen were all but silent about Polish help to Jews and German punishment for such help. Almost nothing was said of the German role in inciting Polish betrayals the policemen so hypocritically condemned. Nor was any note made of the fact that large units of murderous auxiliaries, the notorious Hiwis, were not recruited from the Polish population, in stark contrast to other nationalities in pervasively anti-Semitic Eastern Europe. In some ways, therefore, the German policeman's comments about the Poles reveal as much about the former as the latter. 18. Ordinary men. Why did most men in Reserve Police Battalion 101 become killers, while only a minority of perhaps 10% and certainly no more than 20% did not? A number of explanations have been invoked in the past to explain such behavior. Wartime brutalization, racism, segmentation and routinization of the task, special selection of the perpetrators, careerism, obedience to orders, deference to authority, ideological indoctrination, and conformity. These factors are applicable in varying degrees, but none without qualification. Wars have invariably been accompanied by atrocities. As John Dower has noted in his remarkable book, War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War, war hates induce war crimes. Above all, when deeply embedded negative racial stereotypes are added to the brutalization inherent in sending armed men to kill one another on a massive scale, the fragile tissue of war conventions and rules of combat is even more frequently and viciously broken on all sides. Hence the difference between more conventional war, between Germany and the Western Allies, for example, and the race wars of the recent past. From the Nazi war of destruction in Eastern Europe and war against the Jews to the war without mercy in the Pacific and most recently Vietnam, soldiers have all too often tortured and slaughtered unarmed civilians and helpless prisoners and committed numerous other atrocities. Dower's account of entire American units in the Pacific openly boasting of a take-no-prisoners policy and routinely collecting body parts of Japanese soldiers as battlefield souvenirs is chilling reading for anyone who smugly assumes that war atrocities were a monopoly of the Nazi regime. War, and especially race war, leads to brutalization, which leads to atrocity. This common thread, it could be argued, runs from Bromberg and Babi Yar through New Guinea and Manila and on to My Lai. But if war, and especially race war, was a vital context within which Reserve Police Battalion 101 operated, as I shall indeed argue, how much does the notion of wartime brutalization explain the specific behavior of the policemen at Józefów and after? In particular, what distinctions must be made between various kinds of war crimes and the mindsets of the men who commit them? Many of the most notorious wartime atrocities, Oradour and Malmedy, the Japanese rampage through Manila, the American slaughter of prisoners and mutilation of corpses on many Pacific islands, and the massacre at My Lai, involved a kind of battlefield frenzy. Soldiers who were inured to violence, numbed to the taking of human life, embittered over their own casualties, and frustrated by the tenacity of an insidious and seemingly inhuman enemy, sometimes exploded and at other times grimly resolved to have their revenge at the first opportunity. Though atrocities of this kind were too often tolerated, condoned, or tacitly, sometimes even explicitly, encouraged by elements of the command structure, they did not represent official government policy. Despite the hate-filled propaganda of each nation and the exterminatory rhetoric of many leaders and commanders, such atrocities still represented a breakdown in discipline and the chain of command. They were not standard operating procedure. Other kinds of atrocity, lacking the immediacy of battlefield frenzy and fully expressing official government policy, decidedly were standard operating procedure. The firebombing of German and Japanese cities, the enslavement and murderous maltreatment of foreign laborers in German camps and factories or along the Siam-Burma Railroad, the reprisal shooting of 100 civilians for every German soldier killed by partisan attack in Yugoslavia or elsewhere in Eastern Europe, These were not the spontaneous explosions or cruel revenge of brutalized men, but the methodically executed policies of government. Both kinds of atrocities occur in the brutalizing context of war, but the men who carry out atrocity by policy are in a different state of mind. They act not out of frenzy, bitterness, and frustration, but with calculation. Clearly, the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101, in implementing the systematic Nazi policy of exterminating European Jewry, belong in the second category. Except for a few of the oldest men who were veterans of World War I, and a few NCOs who had been transferred to Poland from Russia, the men of the battalion had not seen battle or encountered a deadly enemy. Most of them had not fired a shot in anger or ever been fired on, much less lost comrades fighting at their side. Thus, wartime brutalization through prior combat was not an immediate experience directly influencing the policeman's behavior at Yuzefov. Once the killing began, however, the men became increasingly brutalized. As in combat, the horrors of the initial encounter eventually became routine, and the killing became progressively easier. In this sense, brutalization was not the cause, but the effect of these men's behavior. The context of war must surely be taken into account in a more general way than as a cause of combat-induced brutalization and frenzy, however. War, a struggle between our people and the enemy, creates a polarized world in which the enemy is easily objectified and removed from the community of human obligation. War is the most conducive environment in which governments can adopt atrocity by policy and encounter few difficulties in implementing it. As John Dower has observed, the dehumanization of the other contributed immeasurably to the psychological distancing that facilitated killing. Distancing, not frenzy and brutalization, is one of the keys to the behavior of Reserve Police Battalion 101. War and negative racial stereotyping were two mutually reinforcing factors in this distancing. Many scholars of the Holocaust, especially Raoul Hilberg, have emphasized the bureaucratic and administrative aspects of the destruction process. This approach emphasizes the degree to which modern bureaucratic life fosters a functional and physical distancing in the same way that war and negative racial stereotyping promote a psychological distancing between perpetrator and victim. Indeed, many of the perpetrators of the Holocaust were so-called desk murderers, whose role in the mass extermination was greatly facilitated by the bureaucratic nature of their participation. Their jobs frequently consisted of tiny steps in the overall killing process, and they performed them in a routine manner, never seeing the victims their actions affected. Segmented, routinized, and depersonalized, the job of the bureaucrat or specialist, whether it involved confiscating property, scheduling trains, drafting legislation, sending telegrams, or compiling lists, could be performed without confronting the reality of mass murder. Such a luxury, of course, was not enjoyed by the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101, who were quite literally saturated in the blood of victims shot at point-blank range. No one confronted the reality of mass murder more directly than the men in the woods at Yuzefov. Segmentation and routinization, the depersonalizing aspects of bureaucratized killing, cannot explain the battalion's initial behavior there. The facilitating psychological effect of a division of labor for the killing process was not totally negligible, however. While members of the battalion did indeed carry out further shootings single-handed at Serokolma, Talsin, and Kotsk, and later in the course of innumerable Jew hunts, the larger actions involved joint ventures and splitting of duties. The policemen always provided the cordon, and many were directly involved in driving the Jews from their homes to the assembly point and then to the death trains. But at the largest mass shootings, specialists were brought in to do the killing. At Womazi, the Hivis would have done the shooting by themselves if they had not been too drunk to finish the job. At Majdanek and Poniatowa during Erntefest, the security police of Lublin furnished the shooters. The deportations to Treblinka had an added advantage psychologically. Not only was the killing done by others, but it was done out of sight of the men who cleared the ghettos and forced the Jews onto the death trains. After the sheer horror of Yuzefov, the policemen's detachment, their sense of not really participating in or being responsible for their subsequent actions in ghetto clearing and cordon duty, is stark testimony to the desensitizing effects of division of labor. To what degree, if any, did the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 represent a process of special selection for the particular task of implementing the final solution? According to recent research by the German historian Hans Heinrich Wilhelm, considerable time and effort was expended by the personnel department of Beinhard Heydrich's Bike Security main office to select and assign officers for the Einsatzgruppen. Himmler, anxious to get the right men for the right job, was also careful in his selection of higher SS and police leaders and others in key positions. Hence, his insistence on keeping the unsavory Globochnik in Lublin, despite his past record of corruption and objections to his appointment even within the Nazi Party. In her book, Into That Darkness, a classic study of Franz Stangl, the commandant of Treblinka, Gitta Sereni concluded that special care must have been taken to choose just 96 of some 400 people to be transferred from the euthanasia program in Germany to the death camps in Poland. Did any similar policy of selection, the careful choosing of personnel particularly suited for mass murder, determine the makeup of Reserve Police Battalion 101? Concerning the rank and file, the answer is a qualified no. By most criteria, in fact, just the opposite was the case. By age, geographical origin, and social background, the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 were least likely to be considered apt material out of which to mold future mass killers. On the basis of these criteria, the rank and file, middle-aged, mostly working class from Hamburg, did not represent special selection or even random selection, but for all practical purposes, negative selection for the task at hand. In one respect, however, an earlier and more general form of selection may have taken place. The high percentage, 25% of party members among the battalion's rank and file, particularly disproportionate for those of working-class origin, suggests that the initial conscription of reservists, long before their use as killers in the final solution was envisaged, was not entirely random. If Himmler at first thought of the reservists as a potential internal security force, while large numbers of active police were stationed abroad, it is logical that he would have been leery of conscripting men of dubious political reliability. One solution would have been to draft middle-aged party members for reserve duty in higher proportions than from the population at large. But the existence of such a policy is merely a suspicion, for no documents have been found to prove that party members were deliberately drafted into the reserve units of the order police. The case for special selection of officers is even more difficult to make. By SS standards, Major Trapp was a patriotic German, but traditional and overly sentimental, what in Nazi Germany was scornfully considered both weak and reactionary. It is certainly revealing that despite the conscious effort of Himmler and Heydrich to amalgamate the SS and the police, and despite the fact that Trapp was a decorated World War I veteran, career policeman, and Alter Kampfer, who joined the party in 1932, he was never taken into the SS. He was certainly not given command of Reserve Police Battalion 101 and specifically assigned to the Lublin district because of his presumed suitability as a mass killer. The remaining officers of the battalion scarcely evidence a policy of careful selection either. Despite their impeccable party credentials, both Hoffmann and Wolow had been shunted into slow-track careers by SS standards. Wolow's career in the order police in particular was marked by mediocre, even negative evaluations. Ironically, it was the relatively old, 48, Reserve Lieutenant Gnade, not the two young SS captains, who turned out to be the most ruthless and sadistic killer, a man who took pleasure in his work. Finally, the assignment of Reserve Lieutenant Buchmann could scarcely have been made by anyone consciously selecting prospective killers. In short, Reserve Police Battalion 101 was not sent to Lublin to murder Jews because it was composed of men specially selected or deemed particularly suited for the task. On the contrary, the battalion was the dregs of the manpower pool available at that stage of the war. It was employed to kill Jews because it was the only kind of unit available for such behind-the-lines duties. Most likely, Globochnik simply assumed as a matter of course that whatever battalion came his way would be up to this murderous task, regardless of its composition. If so, he may have been disappointed in the immediate aftermath of Yuzefov, but in the long run, events proved him correct. Many studies of Nazi killers have suggested a different kind of selection, namely self-selection to the party and SS by unusually violence-prone people. Shortly after the war, Theodor Adorno and others developed the notion of the authoritarian personality. Feeling that situational or environmental influences had already been studied, they chose to focus on hitherto neglected psychological factors. They began with the hypothesis that certain deep-seated personality traits made potentially fascistic individuals particularly susceptible to anti-democratic propaganda. Their investigations led them to compile a list of the crucial traits, tested for by the so-called F-scale, of the authoritarian personality: rigid adherence to conventional values, submissiveness to authority figures, aggressiveness toward outgroups, opposition to introspection, reflection, and creativity, a tendency to superstition and stereotyping, preoccupation with power and toughness, destructiveness and cynicism, projectivity, the disposition to believe that wild and dangerous things go on in the world, and the projection outward of unconscious emotional impulses, and an exaggerated concern with sexuality. They concluded that the anti-democratic individual harbors strong underlying aggressive impulses, and fascistic movements allow him to project this aggression through sanctioned violence against ideologically targeted outgroups. Zygmunt Bauman has summed up this approach as follows: Nazism was cruel because Nazis were cruel, and the Nazis were cruel because cruel people tended to become Nazis. He is highly critical of the methodology of Adorno and his colleagues, which neglected social influences, and of the implication that ordinary people did not commit fascist atrocities. Subsequent advocates of a psychological explanation have modified the Adorno approach by more explicitly merging psychological and situational, social, cultural, and institutional factors. Studying a group of men who had volunteered for the SS, John Steiner concluded that a self-selection process for brutality appears to exist. He proposed the notion of the sleeper, certain personality characteristics of violence-prone individuals that usually remain latent but can be activated under certain conditions. In the chaos of post-World War I Germany, people testing high on the F-scale were attracted in disproportionate numbers to National Socialism as a subculture of violence, and in particular to the SS, which provided the incentives and support for the full realization of their violent potential. After World War II, such men reverted to law-abiding behavior. Thus, Steiner concludes that the situation tended to be the most immediate determinant of SS behavior in rousing the sleeper. Erwin Staub accepts the notion that some people become perpetrators as a result of their personality. They are self-selected. But he concludes that Steiner's sleeper is a very common trait, and that under particular circumstances, most people have a capacity for extreme violence and the destruction of human life. Indeed, Staub is quite emphatic that ordinary psychological processes and normal, common human motivations and certain basic but not inevitable tendencies in human thought and feeling are the primary sources of the human capacity for mass destruction of human life. Evil that arises out of ordinary thinking and is committed by ordinary people is the norm, not the exception. If Staub makes Steiner's sleeper unexceptional, Zygmunt Bauman goes so far as to dismiss it as a metaphysical prop. For Bauman, Cruelty is social in its origin much more than it is characterological. Bauman argues that most people slip into the roles society provides them, and he is very critical of any implication that faulty personalities are the cause of human cruelty. For him, the exception, the real sleeper, is the rare individual who has the capacity to resist authority and assert moral autonomy, but who is seldom aware of this hidden strength until put to the test. Those who emphasize the relative or absolute importance of situational factors over individual psychological characteristics invariably point to Philip Zimbardo's Stanford Prison Experiment. Screening out everyone who scored beyond the normal range on a battery of psychological tests, including one that measured rigid adherence to conventional values and a submissive, uncritical attitude toward authority, i.e., the F scale for the authoritarian personality, Zimbardo randomly divided his homogeneous, normal test group into guards and prisoners, and placed them in a simulated prison. Though outright physical violence was barred, within 6 days, the inherent structure of prison life, in which guards operating on three-man shifts have to devise ways of controlling the more numerous prisoner population, had produced rapidly escalating brutality, humiliation, and dehumanization. Most dramatic and distressing to us was the observation of the ease with which sadistic behavior could be elicited in individuals who were not sadistic types. The prison situation alone, Zimbardo concluded, was a sufficient condition to produce aberrant antisocial behavior. Perhaps most relevant to this study of Reserve Police Battalion 101 is the spectrum of behavior that Zimbardo discovered in his sample of 11 guards. About one-third of the guards emerged as cruel and tough. They constantly invented new forms of harassment and enjoyed their newfound power to behave cruelly and arbitrarily. A middle group of guards was tough but fair. They played by the rules and did not go out of their way to mistreat prisoners. Only two, i.e., less than 20%, emerged as good guards who did not punish prisoners and even did small favors for them. Zimbardo's spectrum of guard behavior bears an uncanny resemblance to the groupings that emerged within Reserve Police Battalion 101. A nucleus of increasingly enthusiastic killers who volunteered for the firing squads and Jew hunts, a larger group of policemen who performed as shooters and ghetto clearers when assigned, but who did not seek opportunities to kill, and in some cases refrained from killing, contrary to standing orders when no one was monitoring their actions, and a small group, less than 20%, of refusers and evaders. In addition to this striking resemblance between Zimbardo's guards and the policemen of Reserve Police Battalion 101, one other factor must be taken into account in weighing the relevance of self-selection on the basis of psychological predisposition. The battalion was composed of reserve lieutenants and men who had simply been conscripted after the outbreak of the war. The non-commissioned officers had joined the order police before the war because they hoped either to pursue a career in the police, in this case the Metropolitan Police of Hamburg, not the political police or Gestapo, or to avoid being drafted into the army. In these circumstances, it is difficult to perceive any mechanism of self-selection through which the reserve battalions of the order police could have attracted an unusual concentration of men of violent predisposition. Indeed, if Nazi Germany offered unusually numerous career paths that sanctioned and rewarded violent behavior, random conscription from the remaining population, already drained of its most violence-prone individuals, would arguably produce even less than an average number of authoritarian personalities. Self-selection on the basis of personality traits, in short, offers little to explain the behavior of the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101. If special selection played little role and self-selection seemingly none, what about self-interest and careerism? Those who admitted being among the shooters did not justify their behavior on the basis of career considerations. In contrast, however, the issue of careerism was most clearly articulated by several of those who did not shoot. Lieutenant Buchmann and Gustav Michelson, in explaining their exceptional behavior, noted that unlike their fellow officers or comrades, they had well-established civilian careers to return to and did not need to consider possible negative repercussions on a future career in the police. Buchmann was clearly reluctant to have the prosecution use his behavior against the defendants, and thus may have emphasized the career factor as constituting less of a moral indictment of men who acted differently. But Michelson's testimony was not influenced by any such calculations or reticence. In addition to the testimony of those who felt free of career considerations, there is the behavior of those who clearly did not. Captain Hoffmann is the classic example of a man driven by careerism. Crippled by stomach cramps, psychosomatically induced, at least in part, if not entirely, by the murderous actions of the battalion, he tenaciously tried to hide his illness from his superiors rather than use it to escape his situation. He risked his men's open suspicion of cowardice in a vain attempt to keep his company command. And when he was finally relieved, he bitterly contested that career-threatening development as well. Given the number of men from Reserve Police Battalion 101 who remained in the police after the war, career ambitions must have played an important role for many others as well. Among the perpetrators, of course, orders have traditionally been the most frequently cited explanation for their own behavior. The authoritarian political culture of the Nazi dictatorship, savagely intolerant of overt dissent, along with the standard military necessity of obedience to orders and ruthless enforcement of discipline, created a situation in which individuals had no choice. Orders were orders, and no one in such a political climate could be expected to disobey them, they insisted. Disobedience surely meant the concentration camp, if not immediate execution, possibly for their families as well. The perpetrators had found themselves in a situation of impossible duress and therefore could not be held responsible for their actions. Such, at least, is what defendants said in trial after trial in post-war Germany. There is a general problem with this explanation, however. Quite simply, in the past 45 years, no defense attorney or defendant in any of the hundreds of post-war trials has been able to document a single case in which refusal to obey an order to kill unarmed civilians resulted in the allegedly inevitable dire punishment. The punishment or censure that occasionally did result from such disobedience was never commensurate with the gravity of the crimes the men had been asked to commit. A variation on the explanation of inescapable orders is putative duress. Even if the consequences of disobedience would not have been so dire, the men who complied could not have known that at the time. They sincerely thought that they had had no choice when faced with orders to kill. Undoubtedly, in many units, zealous officers bullied their men with ominous threats. In Reserve Police Battalion 101, as we have seen, certain officers and NCOs like Drucker and Herget tried to make everyone shoot initially, even if they subsequently released those not up to continuing. And other officers and NCOs like Hoppner and Ostmann picked out individuals known as non-shooters and pressured them to kill, sometimes successfully. But as a general rule, even putative duress does not hold for Reserve Police Battalion 101. From the time Major Trapp, with choked voice and tears streaming down his cheeks, offered to excuse those not up to it at Yusefov, and protected the first man to take up his offer from Captain Hoffmann's wrath, a situation of putative duress did not exist in the battalion. Trapp's subsequent behavior, not just excusing Lieutenant Buchmann from participation in Jewish actions, but clearly protecting a man who made no secret of his disapproval, only made matters clearer. A set of unwritten ground rules emerged within the battalion. For small shooting actions, volunteers were requested, or shooters were chosen from among those who were known to be willing to kill, or who simply did not make the effort to keep their distance when firing squads were being formed. For large actions, those who would not kill were not compelled. Even officers' attempts to force individual non-shooters to kill could be refused, for the men knew that the officers could not appeal to Major Trapp. Everyone but the most open critics, like Buchmann, did have to participate in cordon duty and roundups, but in such circumstances, individuals could still make their own decisions about shooting. The testimonies are filled with stories of men who disobeyed standing orders during the ghetto clearing operations and did not shoot infants or those attempting to hide or escape. Even men who admitted to having taken part in firing squads claimed not to have shot in the confusion and melee of the ghetto clearings or out on patrol when their behavior could not be closely observed. If obedience to orders out of fear of dire punishment is not a valid explanation, what about obedience to authority, in the more general sense, used by Stanley Milgram? Deference simply as a product of socialization and evolution, a deeply ingrained behavior tendency to comply with the directives of those positioned hierarchically above, even to the point of performing repugnant actions in violation of universally accepted moral norms. In a series of now famous experiments, Milgram tested the individual's ability to resist authority that was not backed by any external coercive threat. Naive volunteer subjects were instructed by a scientific authority in an alleged learning experiment to inflict an escalating series of fake electric shocks upon an actor victim who responded with carefully programmed voice feedback, an escalating series of complaints, cries of pain, calls for help, and finally, fateful silence. In the standard voice feedback experiment, 2/3 of Milgram's subjects were obedient to the point of inflicting extreme pain. Several variations on the experiment produced significantly different results. If the actor victim was shielded so that the subject could hear and see no response, obedience was much greater. If the subject had both visual and voice feedback, compliance to the extreme fell to 40%. If the subject had to touch the actor victim physically by forcing his hand onto an electric plate to deliver the shocks, obedience dropped to 30%. If a non-authority figure gave orders, obedience was nil. If the naive subject performed a subsidiary or accessory task but did not personally inflict the electric shocks, obedience was nearly total. In contrast, if the subject was part of an actor peer group that staged a carefully planned refusal to continue following the directions of the authority figure, the vast majority of subjects, 90%, joined their peer group and desisted as well. If the subject was given complete discretion as to the level of electric shock to administer, all but a few sadists consistently delivered a minimal shock. When not under direct surveillance of the scientist, many of the subjects cheated by giving lower shocks than prescribed, even though they were unable to confront authority and abandon the experiment. Milgram adduced a number of factors to account for such an unexpectedly high degree of potentially murderous obedience to a non-coercive authority. An evolutionary bias favors the survival of people who can adapt to hierarchical situations and organized social activity. Socialization through family, school, and military service, as well as a whole array of rewards and punishments within society generally, reinforces and internalizes a tendency toward obedience. A seemingly voluntary entry into an authority system perceived as legitimate creates a strong sense of obligation. Those within the hierarchy adopt the authority's perspective or definition of the situation, in this case as an important scientific experiment, rather than the infliction of physical torture. The notions of loyalty, duty, discipline, requiring competent performance in the eyes of authority, become moral imperatives, overriding any identification with the victim. Normal individuals enter an agentic state in which they are the instrument of another's will. In such a state, they no longer feel personally responsible for the content of their actions, but only for how well they perform. Once entangled, people encounter a series of binding factors or cementing mechanisms that make disobedience or refusal even more difficult. The momentum of the process discourages any new or contrary initiative. The situational obligation or etiquette makes refusal appear improper, rude, or even an immoral breach of obligation. And a socialized anxiety over potential punishment for disobedience acts as a further deterrent. Milgram made direct reference to the similarities between human behavior in his experiments and under the Nazi regime. He concluded, "Men are led to kill with little difficulty." Milgram was aware of significant differences in the two situations, however. Quite explicitly, he acknowledged that the subjects of his experiments were assured that no permanent physical damage would result from their actions. The subjects were under no threat or duress themselves. And finally, the actor victims were not the object of intense devaluation through systematic indoctrination of the subjects. In contrast, the killers of the Third Reich lived in a police state where the consequences of disobedience could be drastic, and they were subjected to intense indoctrination, but they also knew they were not only inflicting pain, but destroying human life. Was the massacre at Józefów a kind of radical Milgram experiment that took place in a Polish forest with real killers and victims rather than in a social psychology laboratory with naive subjects and actor victims? Are the actions of Reserve Police Battalion 101 explained by Milgram's observations and conclusions? There are some difficulties in explaining Józefów as a case of deference to authority, for none of Milgram's experimental variations exactly paralleled the historical situation at Józefów, and the relevant differences constitute too many variables to draw firm conclusions in any scientific sense. Nonetheless, many of Milgram's insights find graphic confirmation in the behavior and testimony of the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101. At Józefów, the authority system to which the men were responding was quite complex, unlike the laboratory situation. Major Trapp represented not a strong, but a very weak authority figure. He weepingly conceded the frightful nature of the task at hand and invited the older reserve policemen to excuse themselves. If Trapp was a weak, immediate authority figure, he did invoke a more distant system of authority that was anything but weak. The orders for the massacre had been received from the highest quarter, he said. Trapp himself and the battalion as a unit were bound by the orders of this distant authority, even if Trapp's concern for his men exempted individual policemen. To what were the vast majority of Trapp's men responding when they did not step out? Was it to authority as represented either by Trapp or his superiors? Were they responding to Trapp not primarily as an authority figure but as an individual, a popular and beloved officer whom they would not leave in the lurch? And what about other factors? Milgram himself notes that people far more frequently invoke authority than conformity to explain their behavior, for only the former seems to absolve them of personal responsibility. Subjects deny conformity and embrace obedience as the explanation of their actions. Yet many policemen admitted responding to the pressures of conformity. How would they be seen in the eyes of their comrades? Not authority. On Milgram's own view, such admission was the tip of the iceberg, and this factor must have been even more important than the men conceded in their testimony. If so, conformity assumes a more central role than authority at Józefów. Milgram tested the effects of peer pressure in bolstering the individual's capacity to resist authority. When actor collaborators bolted, the naive subjects found it much easier to follow. Milgram also attempted to test for the reverse, that is, the role of conformity in intensifying the capacity to inflict pain. Three subjects, two collaborators and one naive, were instructed by the scientist authority figure to inflict pain at the lowest level anyone among them proposed. When a naive subject acting alone had been given full discretion to set the level of electric shock, the subject had almost invariably inflicted minimal pain. But when the two collaborators, always going first, proposed a step-by-step escalation of electric shock, the naive subject was significantly influenced. Though the individual variation was wide, the average result was the selection of a level of electric shock halfway between no increase and a consistent step-by-step increase. This is still short of a test of peer pressure as compensation for the deficiencies of weak authority. There was no weeping but beloved scientist inviting subjects to leave the electric shock panel, while other men, with whom the subjects had comradely relations and before whom they would feel compelled to appear manly and tough, stayed and continued to inflict painful shocks. Indeed, it would be almost impossible to construct an experiment to test such a scenario, which would require true comradely relations between a naive subject and the actor collaborators. Nonetheless, the mutual reinforcement of authority and conformity seems to have been clearly demonstrated by Milgram. If the multifaceted nature of authority at Yusefov and the key role of conformity among the policemen are not quite parallel to Milgram's experiments, they nonetheless render considerable support to his conclusions, and some of his observations are clearly confirmed. Direct proximity to the horror of the killing significantly increased the number of men who would no longer comply. On the other hand, with the division of labor and removal of the killing process to the death camps, the men felt scarcely any responsibility at all for their actions. As in Milgram's experiment, without direct surveillance, many policemen did not comply with orders when not directly supervised. They mitigated their behavior when they could do so without personal risk, but were unable to refuse participation in the battalion's killing operations openly. One factor that admittedly was not the focal point of Milgram's experiments, indoctrination, and another that was only partially touched upon, conformity, require further investigation. Milgram did stipulate definition of the situation, or ideology, that which gives meaning and coherence to the social occasion, as a crucial antecedent of deference to authority. Controlling the manner in which people interpret their world is one way to control behavior, Milgram argues. If they accept authority's ideology, action follows logically and willingly. Hence, ideological justification is vital in obtaining willing obedience, for it permits the person to see his behavior as serving a desirable end. In Milgram's experiments, overarching ideological justification was present in the form of a tacit and unquestioned faith in the goodness of science and its contribution to progress. But there was no systematic attempt to devalue the actor victim or inculcate the subject with a particular ideology. Milgram hypothesized that the more destructive behavior of people in Nazi Germany, under much less direct surveillance, was a consequence of an internalization of authority achieved through relatively long processes of indoctrination of a sort not possible within the course of a laboratory hour. To what degree, then, did the conscious inculcation of Nazi doctrines shape the behavior of the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101? Were they subjected to such a barrage of clever and insidious propaganda that they lost the capacity for independent thought and responsible action? Were devaluation of the Jews and exhortations to kill them central to this indoctrination? The popular term for intense indoctrination and psychological manipulation, emerging from the Korean War experience of some captured American soldiers, is brainwashing. Were these killers, in some general sense, brainwashed? Unquestionably, Himmler set a premium on the ideological indoctrination of members of the SS and the police. They were to be not just efficient soldiers and policemen, but ideologically motivated warriors, crusaders against the political and racial enemies of the Third Reich. Indoctrination efforts embraced not only the elite organizations of the SS, but also the order police, extending even to the lowly reserve police, though the reservists scarcely fit Himmler's notion of the new Nazi racial aristocracy. For instance, membership in the SS required proof of ancestry untainted by Jewish blood through five generations. In contrast, even first-degree Mischlinge, people with two Jewish grandparents and their spouses, were not banned from service in the reserve police until October 1942. Second-degree Mischlinge, one Jewish grandparent and their spouses, were not banned until April 1943. In its Guidelines for Basic Training of January 23, 1940, the Order Police Main Office decreed that in addition to physical fitness, use of weapons, and police techniques, all Order Police battalions were to be strengthened in character and ideology. Basic training included a one-month unit on ideological education. One topic for the first week was Race as the Basis of Our Worldview, followed the second week by Maintaining the Purity of Blood. Beyond basic training, the police battalions, both active and reserve, were to receive continued military and ideological training from their officers. Officers were required to attend one-week workshops that included 1 hour of ideological instruction for themselves and 1 hour of practice in the ideological instruction of others. A five-part study plan of January 1941 included the subsections Understanding of Race as the Basis of Our Worldview, The Jewish Question in Germany, and Maintaining the Purity of German Blood. Explicit instructions were issued on the spirit and frequency of this continuing ideological training, for which the National Socialist worldview was to be the plumb line. Every day, or at least every other day, the men were to be informed about current events and their proper understanding in ideological perspective. Every week, officers were to hold 30 to 45 minute sessions in which they delivered a short lecture or read an edifying excerpt from suggested books or specially prepared SS pamphlets. The officers were to choose some theme, loyalty, comradeship, the offensive spirit, through which the educational goals of National Socialism could be clearly expressed. Monthly sessions were to be held on the most important themes of the time and could feature officers and educational personnel of the SS and party. The officers of Reserve Police Battalion 101 obviously complied with these directives on ideological education. In December 1942, Captains Hoffmann and Wolow and Lieutenant Gnade were recognized for their activities in the area of ideological training and care for the troops. They were each awarded a book to be presented by their commanding officer. Himmler's undoubted intentions aside, however, a look at the actual materials used to indoctrinate Reserve Police Battalion 101 raises serious doubts about the adequacy of SS indoctrination as an explanation for the men becoming killers. Two kinds of order police educational materials are preserved in the German Federal Archives, Bundesarchiv in Koblenz. The first are two series of weekly circulars issued by the Department for Ideological Education of the Order Police between 1940 and 1944. A few of the lead articles were written by such Nazi luminaries and noted ideological firebrands as Joseph Goebbels, Alfred Rosenberg, Hitler's minister for occupied Russia, and Walter Gross, the head of the party's Office of Racial Politics. The general racist perspective was, of course, pervasive. Nonetheless, in some 200 issues altogether, relatively little space was devoted explicitly to anti-Semitism and the Jewish question. One issue, Jewry and Criminality, exceptionally ponderous even by the quite undistinguished standards of the two series, concluded that alleged Jewish characteristics, such as immoderateness, vanity, curiosity, the denial of reality, soullessness, stupidity, malice, and brutality, were the exact characteristics of the perfect criminal. Such prose may have put readers to sleep. It certainly did not turn them into killers. The only other article devoted entirely to the Jewish question, on the back page in December 1941, was entitled A Goal of This War, Europe Free of Jews. It noted ominously that the word of the Führer, that a new war instigated by the Jews would not bring about the collapse of anti-Semitic Germany, but on the contrary, the end of the Jews, was now being carried out. The definitive solution of the Jewish problem, that is, not only depriving them of power, but actually removing this parasitical race from the family of European peoples, was imminent. What appeared impossible 2 years ago was now becoming reality step by step. At the end of this war, there would exist a Europe free of Jews. Recalling Hitler's prophecy and invoking his authority in connection with the ultimate goal of a Europe free of Jews was not, of course, peculiar to SS indoctrination materials. On the contrary, the same message was widely circulated to the general public. How little these materials were directed at brainwashing the reserve police into becoming mass murderers, moreover, can be seen from another article of September 20, 1942, the single item in the entire two series devoted to the reserve police. Far from steeling them to be superhumanly inhuman to accomplish great tasks, the article assumed that the reserve police were doing nothing of noticeable importance. To boost their morale, presumably threatened above all by boredom, older reservists were assured that no matter how innocuous their jobs might seem, in total war, everyone is important. By this time, the older reservists of Reserve Police Battalion 101 had carried out the mass shootings at Yuzefov and Wormazi, and the initial deportations from Parchev and Myonjitsets. They stood on the eve of a climactic and murderous six-week assault on the ghettos of northern Lublin. It was unlikely any of them would have found this article terribly relevant, much less inspiring. A series of special pamphlets, 4 to 6 a year, for the ideological education of the order police, constituted a second group of indoctrination materials. In 1941, one issue covered the blood community of the German peoples and the Great German Empire. In 1942, there was an issue entitled Germany Reorganizes Europe, and a special issue called SS Man and the Question of Blood. A large combined issue in 1943 was devoted to the politics of race. Beginning with the 1942 special issue on the question of blood, but above all in the 1943 issue, The Politics of Race, the treatment of racial doctrine and the Jewish question became very thorough and systematic. The German people, Volk, or blood community, Blutsgemeinschaft, was comprised of a mixture of 6 closely related European races, the largest, 50 to 60%, being the Nordic race. Shaped by a severe northern climate that ruthlessly eliminated weak elements, the Nordic race was superior to any other in the world, as could be seen from German cultural and military achievements. The German folk faced a constant struggle for survival ordained by nature, according to whose laws all weak and inferior are destroyed, and only the strong and powerful continue to propagate. To win this struggle, the folk needed to do 2 things: conquer living space to provide for further population growth, and preserve the purity of German blood. The fate of peoples who did not expand their numbers or preserve their racial purity could be seen in the examples of Sparta and Rome. The main threat to a healthy awareness of the need for territorial expansion and racial purity came from doctrines propagating the essential equality of mankind. The first such doctrine was Christianity, spread by the Jew, Paul. The second was liberalism, emerging from the French Revolution, the uprising of the racially inferior, instigated by the Jew-ridden Freemasons. The third and greatest threat was Marxism-Bolshevism, authored by the Jew, Karl Marx. The Jews are a racial mixture, which, in contrast to all other peoples and races, preserves its essential character first of all through its parasitical instinct. With no regard for either consistency or logic, the pamphlet then asserted that the Jew kept his own race pure while striking at the existence of his host race through race mixing. No coexistence was possible between a race-conscious people and the Jews, only a struggle that would be won when the last Jew had left our part of the earth. The present war was just such a struggle, one that would decide the fate of Europe. With the destruction of the Jews, the last threat of European collapse would be removed. For what explicit purpose were these pamphlets written? What conclusions did this review of the basic tenets of National Socialist race thinking urge upon the reader? Neither the question of blood nor the politics of race ended with a call to eliminate the racial enemy. Rather, they concluded with exhortations to give birth to more Germans. The racial battle was in part a demographic battle determined by the laws of fertility and selection. War was counter-selection in pure form, for not only did the best fall on the field of battle, but they did so before having children. The victory of arms required a victory of children. As the SS represented a selection of predominantly Nordic elements within the German people, SS men had an obligation to marry early, choose young, racially pure, and fertile brides, and have large numbers of children. A number of factors must be kept in mind, therefore, in evaluating the indoctrination of the reserve police through pamphlets such as these. First, the most detailed and thorough pamphlet was not even issued until 1943, after the northern Lublin security zone of Reserve Police Battalion 101 was virtually free of Jews. It appeared too late to have played a role in indoctrinating this battalion for mass murder. Second, the 1942 pamphlet was clearly directed at the family obligations of the young SS man, and particularly irrelevant to middle-aged reservists who had long ago made their decisions about marriage partner and size of family. Thus, even though available, it would have seemed singularly inappropriate as the basis for one of the battalion's weekly or monthly indoctrination sessions. Third, the age of the men affected their susceptibility to indoctrination in another way as well. Many of the Nazi perpetrators were very young men. They had been raised in a world in which Nazi values were the only moral norms they knew. It could be argued that such young men, schooled and formed solely under the conditions of the Nazi dictatorship, simply did not know any better. Killing Jews did not conflict with the value system they had grown up with, and hence indoctrination was much easier. Whatever the merits of such an argument, it clearly does not hold for the predominantly middle-aged men of Reserve Police Battalion 101. They were educated and spent their formative years in the pre-1933 period. Many came from a social milieu that was relatively unreceptive to National Socialism. They knew perfectly well the moral norms of German society before the Nazis. They had earlier standards by which to judge the Nazi policies they were asked to carry out. Fourth, ideological tracts like those prepared for the order police certainly reflected the wider ambiance within which the reserve policemen were trained and instructed, as well as the political culture in which they had lived for the previous decade. As Lieutenant Drucker said with extraordinary understatement, "Under the influence of the times, my attitude to the Jews was marked by a certain aversion. The denigration of Jews and the proclamation of Germanic racial superiority was so constant, so pervasive, so relentless, that it must have shaped the general attitudes of masses of people in Germany, including the average reserve policeman." Fifth and last, the pamphlets and materials that dealt with the Jews justified the necessity of a Judenfrei Europe, seeking support and sympathy for such a goal, but they did not explicitly urge personal participation in achieving that goal through killing Jews. This point is worth mentioning because some of the order police instructional guidelines concerning partisan warfare stated quite plainly that each individual must be tough enough to kill partisans and, more important, suspects. The partisan struggle is a struggle for Bolshevism. It is not a people's movement. The enemy must be totally destroyed. The incessant decision over life and death posed by the partisans and suspects is difficult even for the toughest soldier. But it must be done. He behaves correctly who, by setting aside all possible impulses of personal feeling, proceeds ruthlessly and mercilessly. In all the surviving indoctrination materials of the order police, there is no parallel set of guidelines that attempts to prepare policemen to kill unarmed Jewish women and children. Certainly in Russia, large numbers of Jews were murdered in the framework of killing suspects during anti-partisan sweeps. In the Polish territories garrisoned by Reserve Police Battalion 102 in 1942, however, there simply was no major overlap between killing partisan suspects and killing Jews. For this unit, at least, the killing of Jews cannot be explained by brutal exhortations to kill partisans and suspects. One other comparison is pertinent here. Before the Einsatzgruppen entered Soviet territory, they underwent a 2-month training period. Their preparation included visits and speeches by various SS luminaries who gave them pep talks about the coming war of destruction. 4 days before the invasion, the officers were recalled to Berlin for an intimate meeting with Reinhard Heydrich himself. In short, considerable effort was made to prepare these men for the mass murder they were going to perpetrate. Even the men of the police battalions that followed the Einsatzgruppen into Russia in the summer of 1941 were partially prepared for what awaited them. They were informed of the secret directive for the execution of captured communists, the Commissar Order, and the guidelines for the treatment of the civilian population. Some battalion commanders also attempted to inspire their troops through speeches, as did DeLuga and Himmler when visiting. In contrast, both officers and men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 were singularly unprepared for and surprised by the murderous task that awaited them. In summary, the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101, like the rest of German society, were immersed in a deluge of racist and anti-Semitic propaganda. Furthermore, the Order Police provided for indoctrination, both in basic training and as an ongoing practice within each unit. Such incessant propagandizing must have had a considerable effect in reinforcing general notions of Germanic racial superiority and a certain aversion toward the Jews. However, much of the indoctrination material was clearly not targeted at older reservists, and in some cases was highly inappropriate or irrelevant to them. And material specifically designed to harden the policeman for the personal task of killing Jews is conspicuously absent from the surviving documentation. One would have to be quite convinced of the manipulative powers of indoctrination to believe that any of this material could have deprived the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 of the capacity for independent thought. Influenced and conditioned in a general way, imbued in particular with a sense of their own superiority and racial kinship, as well as Jewish inferiority and otherness, many of them undoubtedly were. Explicitly prepared for the task of killing Jews, they most certainly were not. Along with ideological indoctrination, a vital factor touched upon but not fully explored in Milgram's experiments was conformity to the group. The battalion had orders to kill Jews, but each individual did not. Yet 80 to 90% of the men proceeded to kill, though almost all of them, at least initially, were horrified and disgusted by what they were doing. To break ranks and step out, to adopt overtly nonconformist behavior, was simply beyond most of the men. It was easier for them to shoot. Why? First of all, by breaking ranks, non-shooters were leaving the dirty work to their comrades. Since the battalion had to shoot, even if individuals did not, refusing to shoot constituted refusing one's share of an unpleasant collective obligation. It was, in effect, an asocial act vis-à-vis one's comrades. Those who did not shoot risked isolation, rejection, and ostracism, a very uncomfortable prospect within the framework of a tight-knit unit stationed abroad among a hostile population, so that the individual had virtually nowhere else to turn for support and social contact. This threat of isolation was intensified by the fact that stepping out could also have been seen as a form of moral reproach of one's comrades. The non-shooter was potentially indicating that he was too good to do such things. Most, though not all, non-shooters intuitively tried to diffuse the criticism of their comrades that was inherent in their actions. They pleaded not that they were too good, but rather that they were too weak to kill. Such a stance presented no challenge to the esteem of one's comrades. On the contrary, it legitimized and upheld toughness as a superior quality. For the anxious individual, it had the added advantage of posing no moral challenge to the murderous policies of the regime, though it did pose another problem, since the difference between being weak and being a coward was not great. Hence the distinction made by one policeman who did not dare to step out at Yuzefov for fear of being considered a coward, but who subsequently dropped out of his firing squad. It was one thing to be too cowardly even to try to kill. It was another, after resolutely trying to do one's share, to be too weak to continue. Insidiously, therefore, most of those who did not shoot only reaffirmed the macho values of the majority, according to which it was a positive quality to be tough enough to kill unarmed, non-combatant men, women, and children, and tried not to rupture the bonds of comradeship that constituted their social world. Coping with the contradictions imposed by the demands of conscience on the one hand and the norms of the battalion on the other led to many tortured attempts at compromise. Not shooting infants on the spot, but taking them to the assembly point. Not shooting on patrol if no go-getter was along who might report such squeamishness. Bringing Jews to the shooting site and firing but intentionally missing. Only the very exceptional remained indifferent to taunts of weakling from their comrades and could live with the fact that they were considered to be no man. Here we come full circle to the mutually intensifying effects of war and racism noted by John Dower, in conjunction with the insidious effects of constant propaganda and indoctrination. Pervasive racism and the resulting exclusion of the Jewish victims from any common ground with the perpetrators made it all the easier for the majority of the policemen to conform to the norms of their immediate community, the battalion, and their society at large, Nazi Germany. Here, the years of anti-Semitic propaganda, and prior to the Nazi dictatorship, decades of shrill German nationalism, dovetailed with the polarizing effects of war. The dichotomy of racially superior Germans and racially inferior Jews, central to Nazi ideology, could easily merge with the image of a beleaguered Germany surrounded by warring enemies. It is doubtful that most of the policemen understood or embraced the theoretical aspects of Nazi ideology as contained in SS indoctrination pamphlets. It is also doubtful that they were immune to the influence of the times, to use Lieutenant Drucker's phrase once again, to the incessant proclamation of German superiority and incitement of contempt and hatred for the Jewish enemy. Nothing helped the Nazis to wage a race war so much as the war itself. In wartime, when it was all too usual to exclude the enemy from the community of human obligation, it was also all too easy to subsume the Jews into the image of the enemy, or Feindbild. In his last book, The Drowned and the Saved, Primo Levi included an essay entitled The Gray Zone, perhaps his most profound and deeply disturbing reflection on the Holocaust. He maintained that in spite of our natural desire for clear-cut distinctions, the history of the camps could not be reduced to the two blocks of victims and persecutors. He argued passionately, "It is naive, absurd, and historically false to believe that an infernal system such as National Socialism sanctifies its victims. On the contrary, it degrades them. It makes them resemble itself. The time had come to examine the inhabitants of the gray zone between the simplified Manichaean images of perpetrator and victim." Levy concentrated on the gray zone of protexia, corruption, and collaboration that flourished in the camps among a spectrum of victims, from the picturesque fauna of low-ranking functionaries husbanding their minuscule advantages over other prisoners, through the truly privileged network of capos, who were free to commit the worst atrocities at whim, to the terrible fate of the Sonderkommandos, who prolonged their lives by manning the gas chambers and crematoria. Conceiving and organizing the Sonderkommandos was, in Levy's opinion, National Socialism's most demonic crime. While Levy focused on the spectrum of victim behavior within the gray zone, he dared to suggest that this zone encompassed perpetrators as well. Even the SS man Musfeld of the Birkenau crematoria, whose daily ration of slaughter was studded with arbitrary and capricious acts marked by his inventions of cruelty, was not a monolith. Faced with the miraculous survival of a 16-year-old girl discovered while the gas chambers were being cleared, the disconcerted Musfeld briefly hesitated. In the end, he ordered the girl's death, but quickly left before his orders were carried out. One instant of pity was not enough to absolve Musfeld, who was deservedly hanged in 1947. Yet it did place him too, although at its extreme boundary, within the gray band, that zone of ambiguity which radiates out from regimes based on terror and obsequiousness. Levy's notion of the gray zone encompassing both perpetrators and victims must be approached with a cautious qualification. The perpetrators and victims in the gray zone were not mirror images of one another. Perpetrators did not become fellow victims, as many of them later claimed to be, in the way some victims became accomplices of the perpetrators. The relationship between perpetrator and victim was not symmetrical. The range of choice each faced was totally different. Nonetheless, the spectrum of Levy's gray zone seems quite applicable to Reserve Police Battalion 101. The battalion certainly had its quota of men who neared the extreme boundary of the gray zone. Lieutenant Gnade, who initially rushed his men back from Minsk to avoid being involved in killing, but who later learned to enjoy it, leaps to mind. So do the many reserve policemen who were horrified in the woods outside Yuzefov, but subsequently became casual volunteers for numerous firing squads and Jew hunts. They, like Musfeld, seem to have experienced the brief instant of pity, but cannot be absolved by it. At the other boundary of the gray zone, Even Lieutenant Buchmann, the most conspicuous and outspoken critic of the battalion's murderous actions, faltered at least once. Absent his protector, Major Trapp, and facing orders from the local security police in Wukuf, he too led his men to the killing fields shortly before his transfer back to Hamburg. And at the very center of the perpetrator's gray zone stood the pathetic figure of Trapp himself, who sent his men to slaughter Jews weeping like a child, and the bedridden Captain Hoffmann, whose body rebelled against the terrible deeds his mind willed. The behavior of any human being is, of course, a very complex phenomenon, and the historian who attempts to explain it is indulging in a certain arrogance. When nearly 500 men are involved, to undertake any general explanation of their collective behavior is even more hazardous. What, then, is one to conclude? Most of all, one comes away from the story of Reserve Police Battalion 101 with great unease. This story of ordinary men is not the story of all men. The reserve policemen faced choices, and most of them committed terrible deeds. But those who killed cannot be absolved by the notion that anyone in the same situation would have done as they did. For even among them, some refused to kill and others stopped killing. Human responsibility is ultimately an individual matter. At the same time, however, the collective behavior of Reserve Police Battalion 101 has deeply disturbing implications. There are many societies afflicted by traditions of racism and caught in the siege mentality of war or threat of war. Everywhere, society conditions people to respect and defer to authority, and indeed, could scarcely function otherwise. Everywhere, people seek career advancement. In every modern society, the complexity of life and the resulting bureaucratization and specialization attenuate the sense of personal responsibility of those implementing official policy. Within virtually every social collective, the peer group exerts tremendous pressures on behavior and sets moral norms. If the men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 could become killers under such circumstances, what group of men cannot?